Welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Asharia S., a.k.a. DM Murdoch, about her latest book, Did Moses Exist? The Myth of the Israelite Lawgiver. And yeah, it's a fascinating story about the different migrations of the different people, where they settled, for what reason, how they brought all of these, you know, different stories and myths together, borrowed some, plagiarized some, at some point, maybe even, you know, came up with some of it on their own. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about when in this picture, if you figured out when what we think about Judaism kind of starts to develop the group consciousness, I guess, the nation, the people at that stage. Is this something that's is starting to kind of take shape around the period that we kind of left off at, or does this occur much later, in your opinion?
Well, we leave off at the period of the judges, which in itself is quite interesting because there's a lot of mythology there. But what is missing from that period of the judges, which would be from about the beginning of the first millennium to, or actually it starts earlier than that, but to around the Babylonian exile. So these are pre-exilic texts. They are devoid, largely, if not entirely, if you look at interpolations, of the story of Moses. So these books of the judges before the Babylonian exile in the 6th century, there's no record of Moses in there. They don't consider their founding to have anything to do with him, obviously, because they don't even mention him.
Right.
So that at that point, you can say that whoever's writing these texts, and they're not what we would call Jews at that point. I mean, the name Jew doesn't show up until the second half of the first millennium. Herodotus, writing in the 5th century, has no knowledge of Jews. He talks about Syrians who are circumcised, but this could be Syrians, like Canaanites.
Right.
The Jews traditionally would be considered the fanatics for Yahweh, the Yahweh supremacists, that particular god. We know from even the Old Testament, talking about whoring after, the Israelites are whoring after all these old gods, that they were polytheistic and that each tribe had its own god. So the so-called 12 tribes, the people that they claim were the heads of these tribes, like Issachar and Jacob and Manasseh and so forth, these apparently were deities, not real people. And so each tribe has its own god, which is how the tribes are defined. You know, I mean, and that's often the case. People are defined by their local god.
Sure. Yeah.
And that happened all over the Mediterranean. This is how polytheistic cultures actually got along better than intolerant monotheistic cultures.
Isn't that interesting? That's a very interesting thing to keep in mind for today, even as well. It's something that's lasted all the way up to our so-called modern era, right?
Yeah. And, you know, the Romans had household gods, and I'm sure that tradition dates back tens of thousands of years. This is why archaeologists, when they come across some kind of, looks like a temple or an altar or something, they'll say, well, these statues must be their gods, because every household would have its own divinity protecting it. And so people in the Roman Empire, at least, there was an effort to say, look, any god you bring to the table is welcome here. So, and then we have this intolerant stuff, which forces people to slaughter each other. And that is never ends. This is where you find this so-called Jewish tribe starting to come into play, is when you have these nomads and they're fond of Yahweh, and then there's they're Canaanite, Amorite-ish, Western Semitic peoples, and they're saying our God is superior. The God starts taking on. You can see the evolution of this God from a tribal warrior type, perhaps, and then there's this whole, I didn't go into the volcano aspect of Yahweh, but there's that, and that possibly comes from a whole different area where there were volcanoes. But you see this character taking on the attributes from El. El is the high god of the Israelites. Israel means El prevails. So the Northern Kingdom people were followers of El, who is a Canaanite god, Il Allah. You know, this is a Semitic deity through and through. In the Old Testament, you see the name El is used and Elohim used constantly to describe God. Then Yahweh is kind of shoved in there, and he takes on the attributes from all these other gods, and then he starts getting more cosmic. And it looks like when Yahweh is determined to be the god of the cosmos in this evolutionary development, that the Jewish thinkers are being influenced by Plato. And so that concept may be very late indeed, when God, when this God, you know, this God is very tribal. He's walking around on earth, hanging around in a tent in the desert. He's very localized and not very cosmic in these older tales.
Yeah.
All of a sudden he becomes the God of the cosmos, and that you think, well, that now looks very Platonic. These are very elevated, more, you know, universal notions now taking on this form, rather than this walking in the Garden of Eden and chit-chatting with Adam and Eve and Moses and Aaron, and so becoming a more aloof deity at that point. It seems to be influenced by Greek philosophy.
So looking at sources from outside, you can see how things have evolved and changed throughout time, and then this is slowly kind of being pulled together, and eventually you have something which begins to resemble what we know of it as today. Do you think any of this had to do with the fact that they try to also kind of pull together all the different tribes, the differences between them, to try to unite them under one banner, as is so common in these times as well?
Well, initially there may have been that attempt, but it clearly became a more supremacist effort where the chosen people are, you know, to be the priests of mankind and to suck the milk of the nations.
Right. Yeah.
You know, there's a kind of a, I mean, they go into Babylon too, and then they develop this priesthood these are their cousins, so it's not like they just went in and ripped off the Babylons. The Amorites, the Babylonian culture that was left behind, the Akkadians, even the people who are still there, they're practicing Babylonian religion. The priesthood there, the Mashu priesthood, is very, you know, Mosaic sounding. These are just a different strain of the same peoples, more cultured, longer time of settlement. They were very literate. They had texts. They had libraries. And so if you have a supremacist tribe, the Yahwists, for example, and they want to be thought of as the chosen people above the priestly, you know, the priestly nation above all the rest, they, of course, would be in there voraciously devouring these texts and trying to take this knowledge for themselves and then presenting it as part of divine revelation, falsely presented, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. The God of the cosmos talked to them and them alone, and everybody else is dirty, filthy, you know.
That's right.
Heathens.
Yep.
And when in fact we can see the development of it, that in Babylon you have this Zoroastrian influence, there's a Persian influence too, of course, and that's in historical times where we know about the Persians influencing. King Cyrus is supposedly, you know, the great savior. In fact, he's called Christ in the Old Testament. Persian King Cyrus is the Christ, the anointed one who rescues the Jews from their exile.
Huh.
And so there's that influence going on. And so you don't really start to see the stories of the Bible until after like the 5th century. And then there's this great eruption in writings from, you know, the 3rd, 4th, 3rd, 2nd, 1st centuries BCE, where all of a sudden people are starting to become aware of Jews and Moses and the stories of the Pentateuch. Now you start seeing them in the writings of the day. Before that, no. Nobody'd ever heard of them. Herodotus didn't hear of them. You know, the Egyptians never heard of them. So, yeah, looking closely at the artifacts, the primary sources, the archaeology, It's nothing like what is being portrayed in the Bible. And in fact, once you figure that this is not history, this is epic myth. And now we look at the myth, and it turns out to be, these stories are well woven. I mean, the way they come across, like you mentioned the litany of interesting elements of the tale with the manna and the quails and the burning bush and the golden calf and all these great, my table of contents on this book is massive.
Yeah, it is.
That's a secondary table. If I put all of the subsections in there, it would have been 20 pages long. I think it was 25 pages long, a table of contents. So I have subsections on all of these different elements that are fascinating to people. I talk about the striking of the rock for water. That's a common mythical motif. Of course, the plagues, each of them, how they would have decimated. I investigate them as history and discover that it's impossible that they would be history. But then I look in other cultures and determine, the god who sends plagues is quite common in Greek mythology and Canaanite mythology. And so you can find this is a mythical motif as well. They put all these elements together very nicely. I think the story comes out. It's, no less important as a mythical epic than, say, the Iliad or the Odyssey. But we don't take the Iliad as gospel truth, so to speak. The Iliad is clearly, even if it was set in a place that had been involved in a battle in Troy.
Yeah.
The story itself is not history. There weren't, unless you're prepared to accept that the Greek gods were real and they were actually meddling in the affairs of mankind.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
We know it's not a historical tale.
Could any of this be, I've pondered this on, for example, talking about the Asa through, deities and everything else, all kinds of deities around the world, really. World culture has this component within it. And some part of me kind of feel that, it could have been that at some stage, these are people that actually lived at some point. These might be ancestral stories, but they actually have been so mythologized throughout, them being passed on and exaggerated and, as things happen, like a game of telephone will kind of do that to you in a way as well. Is that a possibility, mm-hmm. do you think, in the same scenario here, that it might have been a story about someone who actually did exist, but that they've been just so transformed through the times?
Well, in the case of Moses, no, absolutely not. But that strain of thought is called Evemerism or Euhemerism. I prefer Euhemerism because it's easier to say. It's based on the ancient Greek philosopher named Euhemeros or Evemeros. Mm-hmm. And he proposed that these tales were about ancient kings and queens and heroes and legends, that they'd been mythologized and deified, and apotheosis is another word for it. But if you look very closely and you have this background in mythology and you know where these motifs come from, that they are myths that have been personified, that have been anthropomorphized, that have been literalized and historicized, you find very few of them are of this Evemeristic origin. Very few. There are some, like the physician Imhotep in Egypt. It appears that was a real person and that he was deified. So there's one instance of it. In the case of Alexander the Great, he was given divine origin. And so there's a lot of that going on, but not a lot of the adventures attributed to these, let's say, Hercules or Dionysus. These are mythical motifs, and you can trace them to where they come from. For example, in the Dionysus story has a lot to do with the vine, wine, the sun, natural elements like that. So not a lot of these are going to be real people. Like Osiris, people say, well, Osiris was a king. This was an ancient story too. Osiris was an ancient king. But if there was a person named Osiris, we will never know who that was. There could have been 10. There could have been 1,000.
Yeah.
There's certainly not a single human being. And in fact, most of the stories that we hear about him are their hidden meaning has to do with nature worship. And so this is the same thing that is revealed with the Moses myth.
Kind of a moot point in your view, right? It doesn't really, sure, it's interesting for the sake of finding out, right? Knowing the truth about it. But at the end of the day, it's about what the myth convey. What is the wisdom contained within it? What does it tell us about the natural world, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't believe how much was contained in these stories, that if you realize they are myths historicized, not history mythologized. Once we get to that point of myths historicized, then we look at the myths. What does the myths mean? Well, you know the tale of Jesus, where supposedly he's on the cross, and this doesn't get mentioned much, but because it's so ridiculous. But he's on the cross, and then the saints come out of their graves, you know, in the middle of the town, and walk through, you know, these like zombies walking through. That's in the book of Matthew. That does not get mentioned much because, like I say, it's just one of the most ridiculous parts of the gospel tale.
Right.
But then we look at the story of Dionysus, and there's a similar tale of the people of Athens coming alive and out of their graves, and you know, so he's like, well, obviously this didn't happen. So, what is this resurrection from the tomb, coming up from the underground? Blah, 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 in the story of Dionysus, which has its foundation in older cultures, like the tale of Tammuz, also mentioned in the Bible. Tammuz, significantly, is a wine god, and based on older wine deities, in fact, a female, Dionysus is depicted as going underground and then coming out of the ground. Well, what that turns out to be is when the new wine is placed in clay containers under the earth to age, and these clay containers are opened in the spring, in February, March, and then they said he is risen, and this often corresponded with the vernal equinox. And interestingly enough, when the vintage and the harvest occur, is at the autumnal equinox.
Mm-hmm.
So these two equinoxes become incredibly important in wine cultures. And as we discussed earlier, the wine industry was massively influential, wealthy, and important around the Mediterranean. And interestingly enough, one of the major feasts for the Jews is the Feast of the Tabernacles, which takes place at the autumnal equinox and has to do with the vintage. And so now here we have, you know, the origins of that festival in nature. And when you start to look at all those different elements, you see, again, this is myth historicized, not history mythologized.
Yeah. Fascinating. It's there's so many different components to this then, of course, in terms of the story and what happened and the development of it. Why don't we talk about some of the examples therein as well, a little bit more detail about those. For example, the Ark of the Covenant and the Ten Commandments. Let's talk about that a little bit. What is that? How did that develop?
Right. Well, a lot of people are aware now that the Ten Commandments have parallels in other cultures. For example, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, spell 125, which is things like, you know, I will not kill. I have not killed. These are confessions before Osiris and other gods, Thoth and Maat, you know, in order to get into the afterlife. And so they've taken that kind of thing, these confessions, I have not killed, I have not stolen, I have not committed adultery, and then it becomes thou shalt not, thou shalt, you know, all the commandments. And it is interesting that with this lawgiver motif that I was talking about, this archetype, there is this double law. So that's why we have the two tablets of the law, But this is, can be found in in pre-Mosaic mythology as well, this double law concept. Those commandments are really kind of just the bare bones. They change from they're mentioned to different places in the Bible, so they change from one to the next. So this is, again, showing you that we're talking about a myth, and they were not handed down on Mount Sinai by the God of the cosmos, as is the depiction in the Old Testament. But so we have this archetype of the God receiving the law, like Hammurabi getting it from Shamash, and there are the tablets that it's written on. Because what else did they have? They had tablets, cuneiform. This is another thing that comes out is, when was the writing developed? There was the Hebrew language didn't even exist when Moses supposedly lived. So how was he writing in the Hebrew language?
Yeah.
He didn't have the script. There was no Hebrew script at the point. There would be Proto-Sinaitic. There would be Canaanite. But the Canaanites used a form of cuneiform. There would be Egyptian hieroglyphs. But there was no alphabet. You know, so the stuff was not being written down then. Those are mythical motifs. And then you brought up the, what was the other thing?
The Ark of the Covenant.
Oh, the Ark of the Covenant. Yeah. I see. Now that makes great movies and everybody gets all excited by this. So it was a magical receiver from aliens and, you know, it had all these mystical powers. And then you find out, well, another mythical motif actually that you can find in other cultures. Any god or goddess worth her salt had an ark that he or she were carried around in. That was what they do. In processions, they carry the gods on their shoulders, or they carry them in their containers because they don't want to reveal what they look like, or it's too dangerous. This happens in Tibet and India to this day.
It's the Pope Mobile of that time, yeah.
Yeah. If the Pope is a puppet,
yeah, exactly.
Not a real person.
Bulletproof glass, etc. You know, exhibiting the true faith. You know.
Yeah, and if you stick your face in there, one of the guards will kill you. So therefore, you die by looking inside. I mean, that's
yeah, exactly.
That is kind of how it happened. If you dared to look inside and discover there's nothing really in there, the priest will kill you. I mean, that's, you know, you can't go around spilling the beans on that. They have nothing really inside there. There's a beautiful Ark of Horus in Edfu, just gorgeous, and that, you know, is long predating the Ark of the Covenant. And so this idea that there's this one mysterious, unique Ark, it's just, it's fallacious. Again, it's this culturally biased, you know, mumbo jumbo that's not true. There were tons of Arks, and one of the tribes may have had an ark to carry one of its gods. All of them may have had arks to carry their gods, and then they create this big fancy story around it. Whether or not there was one lost or stolen, it's probably happening all the time. Every time a tribe was conquered, they probably took the container that the god was in, or the banner, or the ark, or whatever, you know. So I do discuss the mythical parallels for the Ark in this book as well. I don't spend a lot of time on the Ark mythology because the book was really big.
Oh, indeed. Exactly.
There's so much information about it. You know, the same thing with striking a rock for water. We have that water production miracle in several different cultures. The most blatant one is Mithra shoots an arrow into a rock and a gush of water comes out. This was common. The miraculous production of water is a common motif in desert regions in particular. Now, you can imagine how, if you place yourself back in these times and in these areas, you can get a better picture on how these things develop. If you're sitting in your, you know, relatively comfortable home with technology, and you can't even imagine why would anybody be making up a story about striking a rock for water. We got plenty of water. But, you know, but back then, and if you're in a desert region, you know, coming across an oasis certainly seems like divine intervention.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I don't necessarily fault people for making up myths. If they continue to promulgate them as if they're history, and then they use that falsification to take advantage of and exploit other people, then I will fault him. That's a big problem. But just making up myths is a very natural thing for humanity. Let's look at it this way. If you went to all this trouble to develop some kind of knowledge about your natural world that is allowing you to live in a more civilized manner, for example, when to harvest and when to plant, and you want to pass along this information to the next generation. And remember, people didn't live as long back then, so the next generation could be a five-year-old child. You know, you're just desperate to keep your traditions and your culture alive. People are dying at 20 and 30 years old. Those are old people, the 30-year-olds. So they want to pass along this information as easily and as thoroughly as possible. They turn the stories into myths. The sun becomes a sun god or a sun goddess, and his adventures are told as if it's a person. This is what we can relate to. If the sun actually has wisdom and intelligence, which is what the ancients portrayed repeatedly in many cultures around the world, and they still do to this day, it has consciousness, it has intelligence. It's a proxy for the divine. It's the god's eye. It's, you know, it's a representative.
It's the science of the time, really, right? It's a way to explain and understand the natural world around you, and a way to pass this on to the next generation.
Absolutely. That is exactly what we see going on. And when you realize that and you look more closely at these stories and you see the science behind them, then you think, hey, you know, this is actually really clever. It's very smart.
Yeah, indeed.
It's fascinating. It's part of our shared heritage. When I hear how people are saying, oh, all religion is bad and evil and let's ban it, and people are becoming religiously ignorant and illiterate and they're just ignoring it, they're saying it's bad, I get upset at that, because this is a massive part of our shared global cultural heritage, and it's not something to be just thrown away and ignored and say, oh, it's all bad, therefore I can be lazy-minded and not learn about it.
Yeah, it's funny. I've heard from so many people like that. I had to, you know, fuck culture, fuck religion, you know, all of it. I don't need it, you know. It's all and it's like you're turning your back on thousands of years of your ancestors on their understanding of the world around them. And sure, they might have been of a different mind and whatnot, but nonetheless, it's part of us, you know, whether we,
exactly,
we like that or not. Yeah,
absolutely, part of us. If we hadn't had this knowledge of, say, just a simple thing like I said already, planting and reaping, that regularity,
we wouldn't
the
be
species
here.
The species wouldn't have survived.
Yeah.
And then this knowledge is built upon. Then they factor in things like the star Sirius in Egypt, for example. The star Sirius and the three stars in the belt of Orion, very important to the Egyptians, because it signaled the flooding of the Nile. The coming flooding of the Nile was what was crucially vital to the Egyptian people to maintain their culture. And then you have all this mythology about the star Sirius, and the same thing happens then, of course, with the Bible. They've not just made up these stories whole cloth. Some of these stories were incredibly important for their cultural identity and for the sustenance of, you know, the sustaining of their culture. So just to toss it all away, you're kind of ripping out human soul. You know, throw it away. We don't need it. We wouldn't be at this point right now. The Egyptian culture, for example, is an expression of their religion in significant part. And so all those massive buildings, all those fascinating artifacts, you're saying just throw those all away. That kind of mentality is not an improvement over, say, the fanaticism of the Abrahamic cultists, and I include in there, of course, Islam, and Christianity before them. They were all, and Judaism, and throughout the Old Testament, saying all this older culture than us is trash and we can destroy it. And so then they go on these rampages and they destroy all these artifacts and these buildings. And, you know, I mean, they tried to destroy the pyramids in multiple ways. And that's the same mentality. It doesn't want to know anything before itself. That's what we're seeing even with atheists now. They don't want to know anything before themselves.
Exactly. Well, it's a way of controlling the, you know, the not only the past but the future. Actually, it's a way of disconnecting us from that that line, if you will. And it's that's very dangerous to do that, actually, when we lose that connectivity to it.
Yeah, it's dangerous in multiple ways. This this monotheistic combination with the rationalism, which I very much appreciate, the rationalism, obviously. My book is all about rationalism, and my other writings as well. But the combination of the two caused a sort of hatred for our natural world.
Yeah.
You know, it's something to be conquered. It's something to be disdained. It's dirty. It's full of creatures that are attacking us. And so let's just, you know, destroy it. And now we're on the verge, I think, of environmental collapse. And so coming back to this appreciation of nature that has been expressed in these myths, in my mind, is extremely important. It gives a whole different dimension to what I'm doing. And in fact, it's one of my motivating factors. I started out sort of as an environmentalist, and I kept butting heads with religious people. and these were, you know, Abrahamic monotheist fanatics. And they were like, I call it the stinking earth mentality. They were, the stinking earth. I'm from my father in heaven. I have nothing to do with this filthy world. And therefore, it can be destroyed. And mine is like, I love this planet. It's very important. It needs to be preserved. And so I reject your stinking earth mentality. and I'm going to take you down.
Yeah, exactly.
But that is kind of how I got involved in scrutinizing these belief systems, was because, and I was part of them. I was born and raised a Christian in a long family of Christians that date back to at least the 12th century. I know Christianity really well. In fact, my ancestors in America were proselytizers. They were like, you know, Puritans. They came here answering the call to proselytize Christianity to the natives. And so, I know this culture very well, but I went about dissecting it because this mentality of hating the earth and waiting for Jesus to come back and destroy 2/3 of humanity and all the rest of it is just not acceptable to me.
Well, exactly. It creates kind of a schizophrenia, I believe, as well, a kind of a disconnect with the world that you have around you and the elements that your rational mind is forced to deal and cope with. And at the same time, then you're kind of off in the clouds in a way and you know, seeking and yearning for this kind of other spiritual world. And it, of course, necessarily doesn't mean that it's not there, but it means that it's not co-joint, as you say. It's a kind of a hatred for one and love for the other. You know, why not bring both together in that regard? And we've seen other scenarios like this, of course, with the I guess the Hypatia, you know, myth in terms of what happened in Alexandria, you know, the burning of the library, the destruction of various things to mm-hmm. to kind of remove the old and bring in the mm-hmm. new, you know. So that's that's a good point. I wanted to ask you, how did the world, and do you think, not necessarily something you might tackle in this particular book, but become so Israelite-oriented and dominated? Can you tell us more about Yahweh's supremacy that you mentioned before, how we got a concept of a chosen people and how Yahweh then gave them the land, the promised land and all this?
Well, I can kind of, it reminds me of a funny story. I was friends with this Israeli guy named Uri. And I was teasing him one day. I said, Uri, I said, what's with this chosen people concept? I said, the Israelites had no great navies, armies, artwork, buildings. Like, they're surrounded by the Babylonians and the Egyptians, the Sumero-Babylonians, Egyptians, and these incredible cultures, and they got nothing. And he laughs. He sticks his finger in the air, and he says, but we got the book. And so, you know, somebody figured out, hey, we can control the media. You understand? And so, I mean, it didn't take
long. This is borderlining on the anti-Semitic, I think. No, I'm just joking.
Yeah, now you're going to be censored in Sweden, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, we are. I can up in jail here soon after December, actually. If I express something which could be deemed offensive by someone, I could literally be prosecuted for that. So that's our lovely socialist paradise utopia for you right there.
Oh God, you got to sign my blasphemy petition. That's just that's a blasphemy law, you know. That's like Sharia here. It's just really disgraceful.
If we criticize people in power, if we criticize mass immigration or anything, questions, you know, certain historical events, that's it.
That and then I had people say no, that just can't be. Anyway, that's a whole other show that is just disgusting. I cannot believe that. You know, I'm Swedish.
Yeah, exactly. I know. Yeah.
Ugh, I'm just appalled.
Yeah.
You know what? If I could bend these people's ears, I would give them a good thrashing verbally. You know, seriously.
I know.
But anyway, they're just atrocious, treacherous. Anyway, you can't be specific, obviously, but. Good grief. Yeah. Hey, to the Americans listening to this, you know, value your First Amendment rights and
that's
fight.
That's right.
Them.
Exactly.
Not let them be taken away or you are already dead and imprisoned.
But they're trying. They're trying through political correctness and everything else.
Well,
they're trying to shove down our
hate
throats.
Hate speech laws. Yeah. This is why. Did you see our blasphemy petition?
I did not. Yeah, I got to check that out.
Oh, I got to get that to you.
Sure.
It would be contraband probably at this point. Golly. Yeah. So anyway, we're talking about somebody at some point obviously saw that books and, you know, scrolls and tablets, that these are long lasting and can really influence people. And there was a huge bursting forth of literature after the alphabet was developed, and then Greeks went, you know, crazy for it. We had so much Greek literature coming out in the first millennium, and so I'm sure that there was this, hey, let's make a book, and then in the book we'll claim that the God of the cosmos is talking to us. And then when that strain of thought was developing and it was clashing with the Romans, first the Greeks and then the Romans, obviously. You know, this great battling that went on between the Romans and the Jews.
Yeah.
And then there were all these, what we would term terrorists, attacking the Roman Empire around. And I'm not saying that the Romans were the greatest humanitarians. That's obviously not the case.
Right.
But that's going on. And then there's this big fight. I think somebody in power was thinking they're trying to merge Judaism and paganism, which is obviously how Christianity became developed. And then they were also trying to control the Jews. So they turned the great sun god into a Jewish guy who can yak at the Jews, give the Jews there's certain Roman ideas coming out of Jesus' mouth. And he's telling the Jews to behave in this way. For example,
that's right.
You know, monogamous marriage is really important. That's a Julius Caesar's mentality right there. So they kind of formulate this to get Jews into their fold. But at the same time, what it has obviously done is when you attach the Old Testament to the New Testament, it's empowering the Jews as the chosen people who then are the priests and their religion and their culture. And, you know, I have in the book as well, I have this description of by a Jewish writer in the 1920s who says, we have basically taken over your cultures and thrown down your idols and replaced them with us. You have to, in order to be considered an educated person, you have to know Jewish lore. You have to know, you know, your great idols now are all Jews. Mm. You have temples, your churches are all dedicated to Jews. This is, and then he ends by saying no conquest in history could be so complete.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, that's basically, I think there's definitely a contrived effort going on there.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
And I would like to see people reaching back to their own cultural developments.
Absolutely. Yes.
And plucking up, you know, the important aspects. So, for example, let's talk about Scandinavia and Yule. I mean, most of what we see of Christmas is influenced by Scandinavia.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because their celebrations were very intense at the winter solstice. Why? You know, well, why? Because it's so dark and gloomy and cold.
Yeah. That's right.
In the winter. So when the spring comes, and when there are, when, you know, when the solstice is a recognition that the sun is coming back from its long journey into the night. Now it's, you know, the days are going to start becoming longer. That sort of celebration is not as obvious the closer you get to the equator. So they had less joyous solstice celebrations near the equator because the difference is not as obvious.
That's right. You know? Yeah, exactly.
And in desert regions, there's little celebration of the sun at all. You know, they're like, sun, go away. We don't want you.
The moon, right?
Yeah, they travel by the moon. They travel by the stars. They know the lunar phases better, and they're celebrating the moon god instead of the sun god. And then the night sky and all the stars and the constellations, they're navigating by those. They know that better, these desert peoples. So there's that merger going on and that dynamic. It would be best for people to get back to the regions that they're in, have their own traditions for a reason. When I went to the Yucatan, and I was there for December 21st, 2012, waiting for the end of the world, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I was actually at the temple of Chichen Itza, of Quetzalcoatl, the temple of Quetzalcoatl in Chichen Itza, on that morning, watching the sunrise. It was amazing. But the mythology of that region is very similar to the mythology that we're discussing now. A lot of the same ideas, because it revolves around nature, revolves around the sun, the moon, the planet Venus is very important to that region. They're more interested in the equinoxes than the solstices because of they're closer to the equator. But you find the same kind of mythology, dying and resurrecting, you know, has to do with the cycles of the sun every year, or the rising of Venus with the sun in the morning, and this kind of, and it's almost a very pure form of what I would call the archetypal mythos. So if you start looking at that too, then you realize this is incredibly appropriate for this region, and the same thing will happen. Now, I mean, Yule is incredibly important for the region you're in, but it's not. It shouldn't be that important for equatorial regions, and so forth and so on. And this is what we really need to get back to, this recognition of the environment as being the major influence on our religions.
And this, and I just want to add to that as well, that this also, of course, has to do with a certain idea of functionality as well, and things of how you should even look at the food culture and the correlation there. For example, you have less sunlight, so therefore certain things that we eat around June is going to be like fermented herring and things like that's very rich in vitamin D, and I mean all of these things are going out the window now, and people don't understand that geography and location and time of year, all those things matter to how we feel and how, they did better back then than what we do today in most cases. And it's just we think we're getting smarter and understand the scenario of what's going on, but actually it feels like we're going backwards and losing our connectivity to the natural cycles of things.
I think you're absolutely correct, and that's some of those points are very fascinating. For example, the vitamin D concentration in the foods in the winter time, and how we all know about seasonal affective disorder, and this is the kind of knowledge that is revealed when you understand these myths that we are touting as history are not history. That is the kind of knowledge that you can find behind them.
Yeah,
this whole vine and wine data is just, this went on for thousands of years, and we are losing this knowledge. People are very focused on transient things. For example, the technologies we use today, we're not having shared experiences quite as much. The shared experiences are around strange things like, which celebrity can sing and dance better, and instead of natural cycles, like where do we get our water from and can we count on our water? And that's not to say that the ancients didn't abuse their environment. They certainly did. We know that I was talking about the Yucatan with the Maya. Well, they, in order to make their temples pretty or whatever reason, they cut down all the trees to make lime, and then they possibly caused a drought, and that ended their civilization. And so, there's this You have to be a little more intelligent about, you can't just go crazy for propitiating gods and cutting down our forests to do so and things like that. You know, now it's got to be intelligent stewardship. But we really need to get back to that. So we need to know what these myths are that are underlying these stories that are being taken literally, but that are not history.
Indeed, very well said. Let's see here if there's something else there in terms of the how things changed and the way that things kind of got focused. So what does this say, in your opinion, today about the legitimacy of Israel and the stories that comes with all of that, and the fact that it was, you know, wandering in the desert and then finally finding the country and settling down there? At some point we have it leaving the territory again, right, and then coming back again. Where how do you go about this question of the Israel-Palestine, you know, question with all the knowledge that you have in this case about it?
Yeah, it's interesting because there's these discoveries, and I'm really recording what is coming out of people like Israel Finkelstein, who wrote The Bible Unearthed, and other archaeologists, and they're bravely stepping forth and going against this tradition and risking the wrath of people who believe these tales. By saying that, no, these are indigenous peoples. They didn't come out of Egypt and conquer. But even in the stories themselves, they're indigenous peoples. But they go into Egypt and they come out again. They're not just dropping off of Mars or something. So, of course, the Israelites are definitely indigenous to the region. And then that, in that sense, this information could be used for some kind of nationalistic propaganda and say, look, we've always been here. But then that would bring up the whole, you know, DNA issue. Are these European Jews? Or the blah, blah, blah. But it gets really ridiculous because when they've tested I don't know all the details of DNA, but I know that the Palestinians and some of the Jewish population that has been there for centuries and not since, you know, the 20th century with Hitler and the modern founding of Israel, they've tested these different older groups that have been living there, and they have the same essential genetics. These are all Semites. I mean, they're all from basically the same. Now, as far as the Palestinians go, that the Arab-speaking culture actually comes from a different place. And so they're not even really the ancient natives to the region. Those would be the Phoenicians and the Canaanites and the Akkadians and the Assyrians. The Palestinians are not, if they're speaking Arab and they have Eastern Semitic genetics, they're also not natives to the region. So I think at this point in history, we have to accept that migrations have occurred continuously. They still are occurring. Different regions are being taken over by new groups of people. I'm sitting in a country where, you know, there were whole hundreds of thousands of people here before my ancestors came here. I'm not going to be hypocritical and say, you know, everybody get out of the countries that they don't belong in. I would have to go back to Sweden where you were. Or actually,
we'll need you.
What's that?
You're welcome. We'll need you.
I'll get into the faces of those people who are trying to oppress and enslave you all there. But you know, I mean, I have to be cut into pieces because I'm significantly English too. I'm descended from King Henry II and Eleanor of Aquitaine. In part, I mean, we're all like eventually related to, you know, royalty at some point. But you know, so you'd have to cut me into pieces to put me back where I'm supposed to be. It's just a ridiculous debate. It needs to end. We need to just start getting along, and regardless of whether or not the Israelites were indigenous or they were conquerors or whatever, it's happening now, and the fanatics on both ends need to just forget about it. Forget about it. We need to move beyond these contrived belief systems that, once you start getting into this Abrahamic strain of monotheism and the intolerance and everything, it's really been ripped away from its roots. It's now, these are pathological ends of the great world's religious tree, and they need to be cut off and trimmed off. The roots are solid. We can inspect the roots. We can look at the tree, but these pathological ends need to be, you know, abandoned. And I do refer to the Abrahamic cultists of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam in particular, because they're intolerant. They're fascistic. They're fanatical. They're nasty. They're abusive. They're oppressive. They're, like I say, the pathological ends of the tree branches. And if we can go back to the beyond those branches and move back into the trunk and then into the roots, we'll find common ground there. The common ground, this is what unifies humanity. This is what you can have the unification and the diversity in this way if the roots are respected.
Sure, sure. And at the same time, then today, I've seen a couple of good videos on this in terms of like whose is it in question to certain, you know, areas, not only, of course, about Israel and that area, but in, you know, something as mundane as Texas, right, in terms of how much back and forth that has been handed in terms of different, you know, the Mexicans had it for a while, then the French had it, then the Mexican had it again, Spaniards had it, and then I forget all the names of the different Indian tribes that actually had it as well at some point. But it's just, it's one thing we have to get our head around is that all people at, you know, at some point, if not even most of the time, if we look back historically, you know, past a couple of hundred years ago, have been to a certain degree or another invading, they've been colonizing, they've been taking over areas, they've taken slaves, they've fought over territory and resources. And this kind of, I think we are, the debate over this issue today that we're having with our current, you know, moral kind of myopia in a sense, is very slanted and skewed, and it's very unbalanced, and it's also very one-sided and targeted only in certain directions, you know, and it's very, it's neglecting human, you know, human nature and how things were in the olden days, in the old times when people were fighting to survive, basically. And these were common practices, and it wasn't anything that was considered to be, in that regard, I think even wrong. It was just what you did, right? And we forget this, I think.
Yeah, you know, in order to survive, this is where you go back. Got to go back to the basics and project yourself back in time. What would you do to survive? Well, if your water runs out, you move to a different place. If your crops run out, you find some. This is what people would do. They're not going to just lie down and say, "Well, oh well, we just ran out of food. Let's just die." you know, people just won't do that, and we wouldn't expect them to do that. So. Yes, there's been just a constant migration. Even if you're talking about the out of Africa theory, Native Americans are not native either. They came across the Bering Strait Ridge. I mean, that's according to the mainstream parallel. But yeah, this also speaks to the idea of multiculturalism and diversity, which are great in concept. In America, we have a melting pot. It works fairly well because we have a constitution that is very strong in protecting individual rights. But in many places, it's not going to work. And I don't think it should have been forced onto people.
Well, that's just it. It's forced upon us. That's just it. Where is the democratic decision making in this? Where are people getting to choose?
I mean, you know, Scandinavia is a perfect example of this, because Scandinavia did have a culture. People want to forget about the Vikings because of all the glamour and depictions of them, and almost exclusively as warriors and so forth. But there's a whole other depth to Scandinavian people.
Absolutely, obviously. Yeah.
In fact, women were treated a lot better in that culture, as far as my understanding.
It's funny. I came across an article the other day about that, who were slamming how far today Scandinavia had come with our, you know, state feminism and everything else, and then trying to put down like Viking history and stuff. It's like, man, these people know nothing about what's going on there. It's a shame, you know?
Yeah, it's a disgrace. I get tired of this idea that the Scandinavians had no culture and therefore it can be overrun by another one and taken over. They had every right to maintain their culture as it was. It could have been monoculture. People were going and visiting. It was a lovely tourist destination. You don't have to go there to live forever and ever. There was no reason to do what has happened in all of the countries of Europe.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, that is just some kind of deliberate, in my mind, that's like genocide. It's deliberate.
It is deliberate. Of course it is. We have people talking about it, how they have to change Europe from within. We have several prominent people within Sweden, even they're getting state funding, like Barbara Spector, a Jewish woman who is sitting in the PIDEA organization and basically talking about how Europe has to become multicultural. It has to change right now. You know, what is happening? Why are people not questioning this?
I know. It's like saying, well, we can't have variety of the human species. It has to all be one. It's like saying there's got to be one species of fish, or all the dolphins need to become orcas and the whales need to become dolphins. It's just freaking insane. Why is it okay that we're running around saving the whales, but not saving, say, for example, the Swedish culture?
Exactly.
That's just something to throw away. That has no meaning whatsoever. When in fact, 20 years ago, and I'm old enough to remember this, the Swedes had reached a peak of civilization, I think, that was the highest ever. Okay, they had attained to humane behaviors in every field. There was this great awareness of taking care of your neighbors, of animal rights, and so all the great ideals are coming from that region, and now all destroyed. This pinnacle of culture, this peak, all destroyed. It's all going down into the toilet, and people are rejoicing that.
Yeah, of course, absolutely. I mean, it's just get away, from the boring, way that we've lived our lives. We have a lot of politicians actually that are actively exhibiting their Swedish hatred, frankly, and the way that they're talking about how lovely all the other cultures are, but we do not have any culture. What do we have? The Midsummer's Pole and meatballs, and that's it, you know. And these are politicians in positions of power, you know. But I mean, I have my issues with the type of socialism that exists within Sweden for many, many years now. But nonetheless, it certainly was much, much, much better than it is today, and the way that the country is going, and it's going down the tubes pretty, pretty quick. I think we're going to have a whole lot more riots and a whole lot more of the cultural chaos that's going to ensue because of these pipe dreams about creating to be honest, I don't know what they're going for these days.
I don't know what they're intending either. But if they were to actually go back in history and dig up the mythology of the Scandinavians, is absolutely fascinating too. And as we were talking about Yule and so forth, the reflective of ancient practices that were devised because of specifically for that region. And to say that has no value whatsoever. This is some kind of weird self-loathing and hatred and deliberate cultural genocide against themselves. It doesn't make any sense at all.
It's guilt as well. We're being taught to hate ourselves, basically.
Maybe it has to do with, remember, we were talking about the vitamin D concentration and seasonal affective disorder. So maybe all these people are suffering from mental illness and are wanting to see their own culture destroyed. Even as a monoculture, just to have a monoculture does not mean you're bigoted against everyone else any more than, say, you have a mono family. I have a family of people I consider to be close. We have parties and so forth. The fact that I don't invite everyone else into my party does not mean I'm a bigoted against them. I have a right to have that particular mono family, mono culture. And Sweden should have stayed that way. And it could have actually delved into the reasons. There is a culture there, and it developed over a couple thousand years at least. They're finding out that humans – Homo sapiens was in European region, maybe 50,000 years ago. I mean, there's certainly, we have that whole glaciation period that prohibited occupation, but they're now finding bones of people in areas that they previously had believed that were never inhabited by Homo sapiens.
Exactly. Yeah. I came across one the other day. I think it was in the interglacial period. It was some in between there. And I think it went back to about 40,000 years ago. It was a find in central Sweden. Yeah. I remember that.
Exactly. And so there's been people there for a long time, and they have the right to be who they've been.
And this is what people not understanding think, well, you can be. No, we can't, because it's not happening that way. I mean, I'm for diversity. I'm for actually for all peoples. But now we're going to have something which is going to result in the destruction of that. And people who do not see that have frankly not opened their eyes enough to understand how things are being destroyed on this level. And again, we have to look at, you know, why this is being done, because it's being done quite consciously by a political effort. And if, and again, either if this is a pipe dream or someone who's like naive and think, oh, you know, oh, wonderful, great, you know, that could be the case. But nonetheless, the effects nonetheless are the same. And this is going to develop into a real huge problem and major issue.
And a lot of it had to do within the last 20 years of not only these hideous immigration laws, but also constant stirring up of hornet's nests in, say, the Middle East, for example.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, you go in and destroy Iraq. Well, where do the Iraqi people go? Now they end up in Sweden.
Well, exactly. And I mean, who runs foreign policy? It's not our interests. They're being, you know, put upon the Iraqi people, but yet we are the ones who'd be punished for it. The sentiment is even, well, you guys were, you know, colonialists or whatever. So now, haha, you're getting
Swedes?
Revenge, you know. Yeah, I saw an article the other day on this. I mean, we had one ship. We had one small island, like the St. Bartholomew used to be French. It was like under a 10-year period or something like that. And they're like, Sweden developed the iron ore that led to the shackles that went around the hands of the slaves. Ergo, now your generation currently are, you know, responsible.
Well, then, you know, you had Nobel, so. Was he Swedish?
Yeah, Nobel. Yeah, that's right.
Well, then, obviously, dynamite is your fault, and you deserve to be taken out.
Exactly, all of us.
Look, the Chinese had fireworks. Oh, well, I mean, what the, you know, it's ridiculous. Every culture practically has its collective sins, so to speak, but it doesn't mean that
look at this example. The Ottoman Empire had one of the most ruthless slave industries and empire that the world had ever seen. Are they forced to become multicultural? Are they forced to somehow not maintain their own culture anymore?
No, in fact, you know, they're maintaining their own culture and trying to force it on us.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big mess. I think the only solution I can come up for any of this is that we need to go back to our history, not to take this stuff literally, back to our cultural shared heritage, always digging back as far as I can go, because there was a time when, I mean, even just 10, 20,000 years ago, there weren't a lot of people on the planet. There was a great wiping out of people like 70,000 years ago, and then they had to rebuild from nothing. Well, rebuilding at that point means that almost everyone comes from the same genetic strain, you know, and so we're all related. And this constant aggressiveness towards each other is, I think, like when you say diversity and multiculturalism, the melting pot of America is a really nice idea, but it has to be under this particular constitution. If you don't have a very solid constitution that provides individual rights, and then you move in cultures that don't respect any of that and are trying to change it and treacherously destroy your constitution, you should not go along with that.
Well, exactly. There has to be something where you say, okay, we're going to use the democratic process to destroy the democratic process and bring in Sharia law or something like that, right? I mean, how is that logical, you know? Ergo, there's something also wrong. There's something which is there's a flaw and basic design. It's a design flaw within the democratic ideals that now exudes in the West. We have to go about this differently, you know.
Yeah, it was founded upon the notion that people would use wisdom and would be better educated, who would be determining policy.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not, you know, demos means people, but it doesn't necessarily mean mobs of people.
Exactly.
Mobs. It's mobocracy, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Well, again, I think if people were to appreciate their pre-Abrahamic culture as developed through the wisdom of people making observations of their natural environment, this would go a long way in reversing what is, in my mind, a form of mental illness that is being spread everywhere.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And we've talked about that now quite a bit on the program to try to get people to realize this. And this is concerning all peoples around the world. This is concerning wherever you are, wherever your cultural heritage lie. Examine, go deep, find your roots, find that. It's a tremendous gratification in the process. And at the same time, just because you are trying to advocate an awakening and an identification about this process does not mean that you're that you're for the elimination of other people, for the violence against someone else, for the destruction of anyone. And this is also ideas I've heard flown around where people actually are, they're running with an idea and assumes that, you know, just because you do have a in that regard, a sense of your own people and all that, that this means that the exclusion or destruction of someone else, which is completely erroneous. And it's frankly an extremist view upon an idea, which is very sound. But of course, they're running away with it, unfortunately, because they can't, who knows, understand it or cope with it, or they dislike it for some political reason or something like that. But, you know, there you go.
Right. And it also, you're absolutely right. And that's well said. And also, it doesn't mean that you're going to become a fanatic of, let's say, ancient pre-Abrahamic religion. You don't have to necessarily have to go say, well, it's absolutely true then. That's not it either. When we're talking about mysticism this whole time, this mythicist perspective of looking at ancient myths and seeing what their meaning is, acknowledging them as myths, first of all, looking at their meaning, you don't have to be a follower of those myths. You don't have to say those myths. In fact, you wouldn't say those myths are little history and then become fanatical. That's not what we're talking about. But appreciating what they're trying to convey, appreciating why they were developed, who they were developed by. Let me use this as an example of Persia, okay? The Persians had a pretty darn good culture. There was, you know, I mean, nobody's perfect. There's some problems with it. I wouldn't say it was, there's some typical human problems with it. But they did not need Islam, okay? And now today, on the good side, if we look at something cheerful, a lot of Persians are waking up. Yeah, they call themselves Iranians. They call themselves Persians. They're waking up and saying, hey, you know what? We had a culture.
Yeah.
It was a good one.
Yeah.
It was very old. It had great holidays. They still were able to maintain their holidays, like Nowruz, which is the vernal equinox, the spring celebration. Very important. They're recognizing the spring celebration. It probably goes back 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years in that region, maybe even more. They weren't speaking Persian at that time, but you know, whoever was living there. But they didn't need this new thing to come in and invade and take over and enslave and oppress the people and the women in particular in recent decades.
Yeah.
Under its most fanatical strain. You know, they had a great culture. And a lot of the people, and I talk to Persians, Iranians all the time, because they're one of my favorite people on the planet, groups of people, you know, a culture. They're starting to realize that this is an invader thing here. This is a cultural usurpation. This is not their native culture or observations.
That's right.
And that needs to happen. If the Persians can go back to what was developed in the region for the region, they can still have these great celebrations of Nowruz and of the solstice, which they do worship, they do celebrate as Mithra's birthday within the Zoroastrian sect. That strain can come back. There's a chance for a healthier world, and I'm looking at now this movement with the Iranian women overthrowing this, you know, this desert barbarism that was forced upon them.
Yeah.
This is great strides that they're making, and you know, the authorities in places like where you are should be celebrating that, not encouraging the oppression.
Yeah.
That they've been under.
Isn't that amazing how that works and how it's that amazing. Switch has occurred? I mean, I've been fascinated to see how the lefties in Sweden, for example, and the feminists, for that matter, too, have like embraced Islam in the way that they have. You know, it's like, wait a minute, what do you? And they actually are turning against, you know, the own Swedish men in this regard, many of them anyway, and instead, you know, open their arms to an ideology which treats you how exactly? You know, how is this going to work?
And how, you know, this is a right wing conservative ideology that's forced upon people through threats of death. Why would you ever defend that? It has destroyed cultures from Arabia all the way to the Pacific. all those cultures in between, the Indonesians, the Malaysians, yeah. those were Hindus and Buddhists, the Afghans, those were Buddhists and Hindus. The Pakistanis were Indians. They were Hindus. They've taken what they've done is, okay, you know, the Pakistanis and the Indians, this is the same people, the Urdu and the Hindi. It's almost the same language. This thing, this ideology that's come in between them has taken these people, the same people, and divided them in half and turned them against each other. And you're gonna encourage that? You're gonna enable that?
Yeah.
That's shameful. That's despicable and shameful.
And then people can be historically against something like colonialism or how people take over territory. But in this case, they just have this huge blind spot and don't see that exactly the same thing is happening. They're supporting conquest, just another version of it. And albeit a slower one, perhaps, a worse one at that too, of course, because it destroys the native culture that's in place or whatnot. But it's still the very idea that it's expansionism and it's run in the same way. It might work a little bit slower, so it might be a little bit difficult to see. But if you're honest and if you open your eyes, it's right there, you know.
Well, it's even worse than colonialism because it's conquest. It's not just a little colony in there. It's taken over completely.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a constant desire for more. It can never stop. You know, it's got to be completely destructive. And then there's no protection. We used to have, we were refuges for people who were being oppressed and terrorized into submission under fascistic ideologies, our countries. You know, that's why they were taken in. So now you're going to support the oppression that these people were fleeing from. We know, yeah, I've got this blasphemy petition. We know there are so many people who want to be free of this ideology. And they can't get away from it now. It's following them to Canada. It's following them to Europe. It's following them. You know, all these ex-Muslims that I know, they're living under a death threat. They're terrified that they've come here. Let's say, you know, I have Iranian friends here who came here and they're apostates from Islam. They've been protected in this country from being killed for their apostasy. And now they're terrified that because of these despicable policies by people who seem to have no morals, that they are going to be killed even now in our Western countries.
Yeah,
this is the fruits of what these people have done. There's no safe haven anymore.
Exactly. You know? Look at Britain too. How that's changing now.
Ugh, and horrible. The
Paul Weston just got arrested too for reading a speech by Winston Churchill in England on his own in his own country because
on the steps of where Churchill spent much of his time.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and by the way, Paul Weston signed our petition.
Oh, great! So perfect. Yeah.
Paul Weston, Pat Condell, Richard Dawkins, Ricky Gervais. There's a whole slew of free thinkers and Christians are signing it too. It started off as an atheist agnostic blog or petition, and then I encouraged it to be opened up to secularists and people who just don't want to live under blasphemy laws.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter who you are. You can be a Christian. I don't care. Just as long as you don't want to live under blasphemy laws, please sign our petition.
Of course. And again, there's going to be people, you know, that break the mold, of course, and they're going to be fine with, with resisting whatever is coming in. But there's a lot of supporters for it too, unfortunately. And either they're naive or they don't see it or they're kind of piggyback on it because it's actually a political agenda behind everything. So it's not only, of course, Islam. This is an Abrahamic virus that we've been talking about here as well. This extends very far in regards. What would you want to say to people who, I mean, because from my point of view, I mean, we talk a lot about conspiracy in this program, resisting, you know, the new world order, right? The people understand that the current, you know, destruction and reformation of the West, if you will, is one of the biggest conspiracy and political sinister agendas that's going on right now. But how would you encourage people to awaken to that and see that and see past and beyond the labels that they throw on people just because they have this particular slant and because they realize what's going on and happening to their country?
Well, you know, that's a tough one. I think, again, first of all, instead of just, you know, ignoring and banning and trying to claim that all religion is evil and bad, that really need to start looking at the roots, of course. And when I'm saying that the Bible contains mythology and it was written by Israelites, Hebrews, and Jews, I'm not saying that they were bad people who were trying to fool everybody. So this is not an excuse to go out and be hateful. In fact, what they did was preserve ancient myths in such a way that, of course, now the whole world knows them. But if we can figure out, we could have a collective awakening to what these myths all mean, and what they really do is unify us rather than dividing us. Once you understand this, this is our shared world, our common cultural heritage. It's something we need to not hold as a fanaticism to beat each other over the head with, but to recognize that there is a certain wisdom within humanity that can be tapped, and it would further our understanding, but not allow, you know, our understanding between cultures, but not allow one to dominate another when one is clearly inferior. You know, we not say, oh, we, the problem with Europe in particular that we're not quite facing here yet because we have so many Christian fanatics in this country, that because it became a leader in secularism.
To a certain extent, that acts as a buffer now, you're saying, but eventually that will be gone, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. The thing about Europe is that because it was a leader in secularism, and that was another thing 20 years ago that we were all cheering, you know, this is like Europe has become wise and is leading the way out of the religious fanatically dark ages, having been the older cousin, you know, of America, for example. Everybody was great. Hey, Christianity's on the decline. People are wising up. They're becoming more secular. That's fantastic. Doesn't mean that you throw the baby out with the bathwater and say that religion sucks or whatever. But because of that, unfortunately, the mistake there is that even if you become secularized, then you have no passion for your culture. That's what the mistaken impression is. You have no passion for your older culture. The religion and everything that it brought with it is worthless. That created in people's minds this void. And so now they think, oh, this is a place without something, when in fact it was not a place without something. It had its own vibrancy. But now we're going to fill that void with this worse religious fanaticism than was, you know, during the Inquisition. And that's the big mistake right there. It didn't need to be filled with anything. It wasn't a void. Secularism on itself is only one thing. It's separating religion from the state and saying you can practice religion in your own private world, you know, but it cannot be imposed on other people. That's all that said. That's all that was. It wasn't a void. It was just a human rights issue. And now we have these people talking about human rights as an offense against their religious fanaticism. It's just, it's crazy. But again, people need to reach down to, you know, what their cultural roots were and stand strong in them. You don't have to hold them as fanaticism by saying that they're better than everyone else, but just say, look, this is worth preserving and I won't allow you to destroy me, drive me out of my land, ruin my culture. You know, everybody's losing their languages.
Yeah.
I'm glad everybody speaks English because I do. But on the other hand, I love languages, so I don't want to see them become extinct. It's the same thing with everything else. I like there's a homogenizing and unifying effect of the internet and of people being able to communicate in different cultures, across cultures. That's fantastic. But don't lose the diversity then.
Yeah.
Because as you said, the multiculturalism is now losing. It's leading to homogeneity.
Exactly. That's what's so funny about it. It's actually a mirror word that they're using there. They're trying to advocate diversity, and then you realize, wait a minute, it's not actually what's happening. Is quite the opposite. And then you have, you know, you of course have the issue of religion as political movements when you were, you know, in deep water and trouble areas. But on top of this, then you have this. I would guess I would call it a straw man that has been created in terms of what Western culture is or used to be and all that stuff, right? Because of our separation from the roots a long, long, long time ago, we've had this kind of facsimile in place. So when that is beginning to be attacked by cultural Marxists and the people out of the Frankfurt School, etc., that's a very easy target and actually easy to destroy it and make it crumble. So it feels like, oh, it wasn't, it wasn't really real. We didn't really have anything, right? So again, it's this idea that you need to touch back to your roots and you need to go back further to realize that there is a foundation there. There's something which has been developed over thousands and thousands of years through generation, your ancestors, things that led you to the point where you are now. And that's what we have to find. That's what we have to reach, you know, far back to and connect with. Otherwise, I don't have much hope at all, actually.
I'm with you on that. Look, let me give you a modern example. I wrote a blog about a discovery in Norway of an ancient site.
Oh.
Yeah. And ancient site of, looked like 12 gods, very classic, you know, reflecting the zodiac, a couple thousand years old. And this wonderful site that could have shed light on the Norwegian culture apparently was destroyed and built over by housing for immigrants. I mean, is that classic there, you know?
Talk about a fuck you right in the face, you know, of Norwegian heritage. Wow, that's just amazing.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to cuss like that, but I don't have any other words for it. I'm sorry.
I know. I don't blame you. You're like in the thick of it, so you're probably more upset than I am. I'm actually personally, I'm in kind of in a paradise, really. But so we don't have quite these pressures on us yet. But I'm trying to prevent that from happening. So
This
is why I work so hard to dig up our lost shared cultural heritage and hope that people will engage in it with me, because it's absolutely fascinating where we've been. And in many ways, where we have been is, the further back you go, it's more innocent. Even if there was internecine fighting and battling and there was warfare or whatnot, they still had, it wasn't so corrupt. You know, there was still back to the basics of just, you need water, you need plants, you need a house, you need, you know, fire. And so do your neighbors. That's it. Now, you know, we've gone through periods of just bizarre ideologies that have messed with human mind and corrupted them, like communism and Nazism and all this, like poisoned our brains, and we need to get that junk out and just become back to where we were good neighbors and, you know, good hunters and gatherers, so to speak. You don't have to live like that. I don't want to live in freezing cold temperatures.
We don't have to. No, exactly. That's just it. People have this idea too. Oh, okay. Do you think you want to go, you know, running around in your loincloth with your spear, you know? That's not obviously what this is about either. We have certain things now. We have developed certain things. It's all great. It's just a veneration and an understanding of what was there. And because again, I think completely moving backwards is not, it's not either the way forward, but the fact is that there is sanity there, and we need to combine that with the rationality, the logical thinking, the everything that we have now, from technology to the good aspects of science, etc. Why not utilize that and move forward from this point and realize that what we're doing now is not only cultural, you know, genocide, suicide, as you said, it's going to lead to such a horrible scenario and situation. I think that has been one of the objectives by the very system that we live in now.
Yeah.
Whether that's a death wish in itself or whether that's just generally driven by a few people or whatnot, I'm not sure about that yet, but it seems to be an interplay there. And people have to wake up to this. They have to realize what's happening.
This is where we would find common ground. It reminds me again of when we're talking about these, what we call astrotheological belief systems that are revolving around nature. It's not just the celestial bodies, but also the wind, water, fire, and so forth. Not saying anybody needs to believe that these are real, you know, divinities or anything. That's not the point. But the point is that if you go back far enough, everywhere around the world, this is what we have in common. And as another example, in pre-Islamic Arabia, the stargazers, Sabaeans, they're called, and they influenced Babylon and the Chaldeans, and then the Chaldeans influenced the Jews, and the Chaldeans were the Jews, and the, you know, and so forth and so on. This is where you would, if you studied the Sabaeans, for example, and they were before, you know, before Islam became dominant in that region, their observations of nature would be similar to observations of nature of other people. And again, there we have common shared cultural heritage that we can all relate to instead of fighting with each other, instead of trying to dominate and be supremacist and destroy and, you know, pointing to this culture as evil and that culture is evil and this one's great. It's just, it's a big bloody mess. Those of us who know this kind of information, I'm working in multiple languages dating back thousands of years, you have to have a universal brain for that. And if there is a superior way of thinking, that is the superior way of thinking, this universal mind brain that can relate to anybody, so long as that person is not, you know, overtly hostile just because I have female genitalia or white skin or something like that, or blonde hair, or, you know, green eyes. I mean, there's no rational, I cannot relate to someone rationally if that's their mindset. Just like I can't relate to someone rationally who's looking at me as some filthy infidel.
Yeah.
It's just not going to sit. I'm not a filthy infidel. And if you use that bigotry against me, I will fight you.
Yeah.
And I would prefer that we go beyond that bigotry and look at each other as human beings having a shared experience on planet Earth who have this common cultural heritage dating back tens of thousands of years.
Yeah.
That's where we need to go.
You're absolutely right. Exactly. And I think, again, this would be, it would entail that all-inclusiveness. That's something that we've had all along. See, I don't understand this. We've had the diversity on this planet all along. And now diversity for the first time is actually being destroyed. and yet we are being told, you know, I mean, I saw an article today out of, I think it was Portland, where they basically said that the city is too white. And you know, there was a too much of a percentage which was white, and that has to go. That can't be anymore. I mean, is anybody walking around and saying that other, you know, cities in America are, that there's too many black people there, or too many Asians, or something like that? I don't see that happening. So it's a very one-sided issue that's happening right now and occurring right now, and people have to see that, you know.
You know, and the sad fact is that it's a lot safer in Portland than it is in Mogadishu.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. You know, so I'd rather not see Portland destroyed by any changes. It's doing just fine.
Yeah.
God, I know. They're going to just plop down probably tens of thousands of refugees from one of the wars that they've started somewhere. You know, just plop them down in the middle and then that'll destroy it.
Yeah.
That's what's going to happen. Increasing numbers of that. We go in, let's destroy somebody's culture. Therefore, we have to move tens of thousands of them or millions of them into everybody else's countries now.
Well, exactly. And exactly. It's a really, really good point to highlight that idea that this is not only disruptive on one level, but on all ends of this whole issue of the horrible foreign policy. And people need to ask themselves, you know, who's running this? Is this on behalf of the people in the United States, for example, or in Europe or NATO or any of these countries? No, it's not. It's being run above our heads by an elite.
Yep.
It's not our decision making, and ergo, we are not the ones. Sure, we bear the responsibility in trying to detopple these leaders. That's our fight to. That's our battle to fight, right? But at the same time, it doesn't mean that just because you do two wrongs, it doesn't make a right. But that's kind of how some people view it right now, I think.
Yeah, and we're doing this without, you know, two nickels to rub together, so to speak.
Exactly.
I mean, most of us are pretty poor. We're supposed to be fighting these wealthy elitists who are in bed with other wealthy elitists. They're trying to claim this is some multicultural, but they're really, like, for example, they're being dictated to by the Saudis. Oh, well, that's really, you know, representative of some poor, huddled masses. The Saudi elite are the ones who are dictating a lot of these policies, not just the Saudis, but the elitists.
AIPAC, you know, a number
of
things.
You know, the wealthy. It's not some poor people who's just looking for a place to worship or whatever. No, it's mega mosques being, for example, being funded by these wealthy elitists who are trying to impose domination on us. So no, you're not championing the rights of any, you know, the little people by allowing that to happen. On the contrary. And so those of us who are battling against this are taking on, you know, powers that are well beyond us. I object strenuously to funding and aiding the terrorists, anti-Assad terrorists in Syria. He may not have been any great shakes, but he was certainly more secular than what is being at his doorstep.
That's why they're taking him down, because they need a more extremist ideology in there.
Yep.
We, had, We had people the other day from, was it some, one of the Frenchmen, one of the Zionists, talking about how Assad had been dumping, chlorine out of barrels from a shopper on people, like these absurd, like, accusations to be able to, like, again, justify, you know, invasion and just another war, another conquest of one of these areas, you know, so they can, well, this is what they do. This is what the globalists do. They run, they work with terrorists to be able to put terrorists in power so that we can create a world where we have more wars and more chaos, basically, you know.
Look at what we see. If you break it into the Sunni Shia divide in Syria, that's what you see. You see a bunch of Sunnis have a whole pile of lapdogs doing their bidding to destroy the Shias. And the Saudis are getting the United States to fight their wars now for them.
It's, yeah,
it's ridiculous. Stay out of Syria. And of course, I'm no fan of Iran, who's on the other side of this great divide. So, but we're caught in between Saudis and the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the Iranian people don't want them, and a lot of Arab people don't want the Saudis in charge, and a lot of Americans don't back these aggressions. The elitists are once again endangering everybody by their bad policies.
Yeah, absolutely.
We can't go along with them, and not being part of an organized cult, you know, they call it a religion, but not being part of this these are run by the same elitists, people. These organized religions, these intolerant monotheistic cults, don't go right along with them. They're doing the same. They're using these, ultimately, you know, intolerant monotheism is the ultimate fascism, really. It's telling you, you're the only one who's valuable. Everybody else is bad and evil and so forth and so on. And it's a great ego boost for some kind of person suffering from a major inferiority complex, but it is not the correct way. I would not be a part of any mob. I don't care if it's a religious mob or if it's a political mob.
Yeah.
I won't join anything. I'm not a joiner, because to be part of that, I dropped out of Christianity after I discovered its history. I said, look, this history is horrible. I'm not going to be part of this legacy. I'm going to say, ooh, that's great. You know, slaughtering millions of people globally, taking over other people's countries in the name of, you know, the missionaries with their Bibles, giving them. I'm not going to be part of that. That's obviously not true. It can't be true if that's the end result of it.
Yeah.
So we need everybody to do that and say no to this. This is the end. Archaic religions need to go, and not banning all religion, but this mentality of supremacy needs to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And people need to ask themselves as well, are you also playing into the hands of those who seek to dominate and control you? Are you, are you part of that dance that it takes to tango, those two parties that it takes to do that aspect? Mm-hmm. And at the same time, then thinking that, by making something, by making two wrongs, we're going to make a right, and this is going to be somehow balance the equation. That's just not how it works. A wrong is always a wrong, no matter how you view it. And well, I hope that people can take this discussion to heart, Sharia, and realize what's happening to all of us, how we're being destroyed, and that people can open their eyes and start looking at this with honesty, instead of just shying away because you're scared of it. You don't like the implications of it, or you feel frightened because of the implications of the power system that you see in front of you. But the fact is, a lot of people in the alternative are still very much blind to some of these issues, and unfortunately they shy away way too quick, I feel, and not giving this an honest view, if you will. So that's something I hope people can take away from this, Sharia. And unless you have something, of course, if you want to add something else to this before we begin to wrap things up for today, please go ahead and do so. I've very much been enjoying this conversation. Thank you so much for your time. And we, of course, want to give out all the details again, where people can, pick up a copy of your book, learn more, educate themselves, realize the history, get into the kind of things that we've been talking about today, because it is so important. It's tremendously important. But so please give us all the details. And if there's anything you want to add to Sharia, please go ahead.
Yeah, it's been a delight to get some of these very important issues off of our chest and into the mainstream. Would be really fantastic. So yeah, my book, Did Moses Exist? The Myth of the Israelite Lawgiver, you can find that at didmosesexist.com or truthbeknown.com, stellarhousepublishing.com, and freethoughtnation.com. And at Freethought Nation, I do a little bit more of this kind of modern discussion that we're having now with news items. And I'm on Facebook a lot. I circulate news items all the time, mostly religion related. Sometimes, like on Twitter, I have environmental issues that I forward, and archaeology is a big passion. And, you know, these works will help people have the knowledge that they need to make it through this transition, this hugely, you know, corruptive and disturbing transition that we're in right now. Is just, it's unprecedented. The amounts of people we have on the planet, the rubbing of elbows of cultures that have been separate from each other, and the destruction of our environment, and all these, we have just a whole slew of challenges facing us. And this is, in my opinion, becoming educated to why we're here and where we've come from and what is our shared cultural heritage is going to be absolutely vital in the future. So I hope more people will join us in that quest.
Well, indeed, exactly. Again, the book, Did Moses Exist? The Myth of the Israelite Lawgiver. Please pick up a copy of the book and support Sharia as well and her good work that she's doing. And a couple of websites here again, then didmosesexist.com. You have stellarhousepublishing.com, freethoughtnation.com. And we're going to have the other links and the Facebook page and everything up there as well. Truthbeknown.com. That's the other fourth site there. All right. Well, I hope we can pick up this again, Sharia. Great having you back. We should do it sooner rather than later. And please keep up the good work. Great having you here.
I agree. It's been a delight. I appreciate being able to speak with you very much. Thank you so much.
We have much more coming in a few days. Ramsey Paul is next. Then we have Paul Craig Roberts, Israel Shamir, and many more. You have our full guest list in our radio archive. I hope you guys and gals have a great weekend and that you think about what we discussed here today and realize what actually is happening in the world right now. It's absurd and ridiculous, and way too many people are keeping way too quiet. So let's break out of that fear bubble and become fearless and look at the reality of the situation and what really is going on. You know what I'm talking about. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks again. Stay brave and keep using that noggin, and we'll talk to you in just a few days. Have a great rest of your evening, day, morning, whenever, or wherever you are. All right, take care. Thank you for membership and for listening.